Oh, hello, my friends, and welcome to Chatting Between Takes, Season 2, Episode 2, : I might be wrong. I probably have the order of the way in which I should say those wrong. Let me try that again. Welcome to Chatting Between Takes, Welcome to Chatting Between Takes, I might be wrong, Season 2. I don't think that's as good. Welcome to Chatting Between Takes, Season 2, I might be wrong. And then the episode, who gives a shit? I think that's it, my friends. I think we just found it. How's everyone doing? How's it going for you? It is a gorgeous, albeit chilly as fuck day in Toronto. It says -7, but feels like -1,000,000,000,000. I'm running errands as usual, because otherwise I'm not really out driving around. Okay, let me start with the most fundamental I might be wrongness since we've last spoken. If you recall, if you watched or listened to the first podcast, the camera dropped, and then I bitched about GoPro. Well, guess what? User error. It was full-on user error. The push button that I thought was the release was, in fact, the way you created the suction. I could practically pull my windshield out of my car before I could pull the GoPro mount off the windshield right now. So I owe GoPro an apology for slagging them publicly. This product is awesome. And not only do I have no affiliation, not only, although hit me up, GoPro, is that I have a sort of a bunch of telescoping ways now that I figured out to use it so I can create. We're happy that we took a sec to explore the possibility, # I might be wrong, because I don't like to do that, right? I want to double down and make it someone else's fault, partly because I was raised in a way that love meant my mom, God fucking bless her, for telling me that if I got the thing, right? Let's say I got the job, I got the acting gig, I got into the theater school, it's because I was brilliant. And if I didn't, it's because the world was flawed. Like, fuck them, they were wrong, the teachers were mediocre, or the system by which they choose is broken. So this was a way to cradle me from pain, prevent it from entering the sphere. And I don't know if that's right or wrong, because I don't have kids that I know of. Hit me up, Chad. Hit me up, Darla, my 14-year-old spawn. But no, I don't know what it's like. And I know that my brother, you know, he tries to provide that safe and loving place for his kids, because the world's going to be hard enough eventually. Or you name your boy Sue, and then they learn fast how to navigate the world, right? So my mother did the former. She said, you're cradled, nothing's going to hurt you. However, what I learned is that if I misread the instructions and don't put the GoPro on the windshield right, fuck GoPro, because it can't be me, because I'm brilliant. And therefore, there must be a flaw externally. My God, the amount of work I've had to do to unlearn that. Now, I'll tell you the benefit. The harder the lesson, if learned, it's never going to be forgotten. It is never going to be forgotten. This is just water today, by the way. I've already had a whooping amount of coffee, so I figured all my coffee intake is mitigated by my bladder. Anyone out there relate? Can I get a hell yeah? When I say hell, you say yeah. Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Because when I say magic, you say powder. Magic powder. Yeah, I would drink 5 more coffees right now, but for the fact I'd be able to do about 7 seconds of podcasting before I'd have to hit the restroom again. So in any case, my bad on the GoPro. There's a reason this is called I Might Be Wrong, and there's a reason why we get entrenchment, right? Like, we're raised in a way that we think this is how the world works, and then the world starts to kick us around a bit. For better or worse, sometimes it kicks us to the top of the mountain. Sometimes it doesn't. But it's usually in our losses. There's that old phrase, you either win or you learn. Yeah, I mean, you do lose. I don't know. Again, don't have kids. Not a huge fan of participation trophies because I am a huge fan of feeling the pain of losing. Because if you lose at something and you care, that means you care. So you should go dig down, dig deep, find the solution. You know, George St. Pierre in the UFC is a great example of this. He came up like all great fighters do with that undefeated, undefeated, undefeated. Then he gets beat. And he's only lost twice. He avenged both losses. But when he came back, he didn't just eke it out. He dominated. He went into what we call the cave. And in that cave, he licked his wounds. And then, you know, he found his mentors, his blind guides who basically taught him, his Pai Mei, how to emerge stronger. You know, and that's one thing we have to be willing to do is to keep finding that we're in a new normal world and then go, okay, cool. Now what am I striving for? What does loss look and feel like such that I can adjust? The flip side, of course, is if you don't care, right? Like you go play, like I never cared much about soccer. I played Pee Wee or whatever the leagues were in Guelph at Silver Creek Park. I didn't give a shit about soccer. I liked being out on the field. If anything, I was just standing there playing defense or goalie, singing songs. It was what I did. I cared about songs in the middle of the park, not soccer. I love soccer. Football. That's cool. Football, lad. Why you doing? Soccer. It's called football. I didn't care about football either. Oh my God. You want to know how much I don't care about football? Although if I were saying it like that, it'd be soccer. I don't care about American football. Last night, my dad's like, oh, are you watching tomorrow? I was like, Dad, if you put a gun to my head, I could not tell you who's playing tomorrow. Like, wait, it's the Patriots, right? And he just starts laughing. He told me, I can't remember. Why can't I remember? Because I didn't hit record on the hard drive because I don't care, lad. I don't care. I don't give a shit. I don't care. If you do, good for you. If you're betting the house, fucking A, I hope you win. Or maybe you should lose, right? Maybe you lose the house. Then you care that you lost your house. You realize you care more about your family's security in a house than a gamble and the addictive adrenaline rush that provides. And in that cave, you then find your blind mentor and emerge stronger. Maybe. You know, I'm about to put a little bit of money into crypto. Oh, yeah, I said it. I'm learning. I'm going to wait a sec. I know what the basic entry points are, but I want to do a little more homework. I've got incredible people advising me. The point is that I'm not going to put enough into crypto that it matters if I lose. It'll suck, right? But I always think about it this way. If you lose, do you just lose the money or do you lose anything else? So let's say you put X amount into the stock market and then you lose. Did you just lose the money or did you lose your kids' college fund? That you know of. If you lost your kid's college fund, you have a problem. If you lost the money, yeah, you could have bought something else with the money, but that's the game and you're willing to play it. Now, I think for me, that's why I'm never going to win big is because I'm full on 100p, not willing to lose big. And I like that about myself. I think one day, by the way, I'm going to do a whole money podcast. When I post, aside from mentioning my sobriety, we have a question about that, by the way. Aside from mentioning my sobriety on Instagram, I'd say in the last year, the most response I've gotten is to a post about getting honest with your money and how I had to and what that leads to. So I think I am going to do a full blown, you know, what did I learn? Why does it work? What's the formula? Yeah, I think I'm going to do that one day. But in any case, there's a reason why, therefore, I'm not betting the house. And my God, if you could have figured out how to mine $10,000, I think it's 1,000. I did the math on it. 1,000 bucks worth of Bitcoin in 2010. You'd have $4 billion right now. I think it was trading at 8 cents at that point. 8 cents a coin. But it's now worth 40 grand up, down, 32 grand, whatever. But imagine that. But if you didn't have the money at the time, like I did in 2010, I'm not a gambler. That's the deal. There's some success story out there about someone who did it, but that person ain't going to be me right now. Before I get into this first question that came through, what I do is I post on Instagram or Facebook. Can't remember if I do it on Twitter. I don't have that many Twitter followers. You'll hear me complain about this at great length. I didn't give a shit about Twitter. And in fact, I kind of only used it to promote the old podcast. And because some of the people I had on the podcast had, you know, good follower bases, Christian Brune, Elise Bauman, Atticus Mitchell, they'd post. And then I'd get followers on the Twitter. I think I had about 5,000 followers, but I wasn't using Twitter. Then I got hacked. I was in Morocco, and I woke up one day, and I was basically following 10,000 accounts that were all in Farsi or Cyrillic, so I couldn't read them. I have no idea what the accounts were. Could have been really cool accounts, but I couldn't read them. But I couldn't find who I was following. I had no feed. So there were programs where you can unfollow everybody you follow. I was like, okay, well, that sucks, but I'll just rebuild who I follow. And then those didn't work because a day later I'd be following 10, 100,000 accounts again. It was nuts. So I ended up making the mistake of deactivating my account before I steered everyone to my new account. Wah, wah, wah. So now I've got like 750 Twitter followers. Now, why do I care? Because I started to love Twitter. I post a lot on Instagram, but I actually much prefer the back and forth, especially because of the sense of humor or the politics of Twitter. Man, it's been a slow grind building back up. I need to find some guest for this podcast or somebody who just likes my jokes and builds back up the crew. But, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, having 5,000 followers on Twitter was pretty good. The standard of numbers changes. By the way, to some of my lovely actor friends, having 10,000 Twitter followers is pretty insignificant. Having 30,000 is insignificant. And I only say that because I know some people who are, you know, very conscious of their followers. By the way, I am too. I could probably tell you within 100 how many I have because I've been actively trying to grow it, especially with Tiny Pretty Things. By the way, if you're watching or listening because of that show, thank you fucking for the support. What a beautiful thing. Social's weird that way. You know, like when you get messages saying, I love you every day, it's sure better than fuck you, you fucking cunt. When I use that word, I'm using it in that Scottish-British way, not as a negative toward the female anatomy. You get it. Maybe that's not right either. Maybe just throwing on the accent doesn't make it okay. Whatever the fuck that was. That definitely wasn't okay. So, yeah, there is something nice, the engagement, which goes back to the reason why I'm bummed I lost the Twitter engagement once I realized how to engage on Twitter. Oh, well, that's life. When I talk to people who produce films and produce projects, like 300 to 400K followers is kind of the new baseline of, oh, you have a following. Like if. And it still doesn't mean you can open a film or back a project, because that's a different type of audience. Who's going to go pay on Friday night to see the movie on opening weekend versus who's going to follow your 14-second clips? Different type of audience. Both are equally valid. I'm a big fan. You know, a lot of older actors grouse and complain a bit. Grouse. That's your word of the day. Grouse. And complain a bit about this new world. I dig it, man. I dig it. I tell, you know, younger actors I coach, I'm like, listen, man, go check out these people who are doing the TikTok and getting 26 million followers. God, I can't remember the girls. I shouldn't call her a girl. She's probably 20. The woman's name. I was following her for a sec to get up on the vibe a bit. And she's totally charming and delightful. And she got cast as a lead in a film. And some actors were complaining about it. And I'm like, have you watched her stuff? She's delightful. You probably know who I'm talking about. Brown hair. Does a lot of dances and stuff. Anyways, it's not what I'm into following. So I followed almost for educational, unfollowed. But I cast that woman. She's great at being what she is. And too many actors haven't figured out that who you are is who we're casting. Your talent will sustain you over a long career. But if you can go get 26 million followers tomorrow, you'll get into some kind of a project out of it too. And then your talent will decide, or not even just the talent, fan response. In many ways, fan response determines if you have talent or not. Does anyone care if someone can throw a football? Like, is that a talent? Does it matter? Why does that guy get 40 million bucks or whatever? I'm not saying they shouldn't, by the way. This is where I'm actually a capitalist, is because I think that if you can do the thing that other people want, you get the thing. Somebody once posted, there's no ethical billionaires. And then I tagged in. I was like, what about Paul McCartney? He seems pretty nice. And somebody's like, don't do that. And I'm like, okay, apparently I can't respond to your post, which is pretty absolute. But I get what they're saying. I also unfollowed that person because if you can't back and forth, fuck you. I don't know why I'm doing this accent. It's not even good. The point, though, is that, Paul McCartney writes or co-writes probably more hit songs than anyone or among. And if somebody has written more since and you write in the comments, actually, Sean, Garth Brooks or whatever, good for them. They came after Paul McCartney, though, so they don't get the compound wealth that he got from doing it since 1964. Him and Mick and Pink Floyd. You know, there's a reason that generation's so wealthy. If they could get through the eye of the needle of getting past retro into some brand of currency. In any case, so Paul McCartney's a billionaire. Divorces notwithstanding. I'm not sure what that did to his fortune. And I think he deserves every penny of it. However, the question then becomes, and this is why actually that person I unfollowed, who I just said, fuck you to, I don't know who you are, I can't remember what your account is, but I might be wrong. Why might I be wrong? Because even the fact that like the plastics and maybe the natural resources that were provided came from another country where we're not paying a fair wage. Or maybe the workers in the pressing company weren't getting a fair wage, like a livable wage. If that's true, then yeah, Paul McCartney doesn't deserve the $1 billion because all the industries that fundamentally let him make $1 billion weren't fair play. So maybe, fuck you, person I don't know, can't remember, and still think you should, you know, apparently I have a resentment. Oh, I got to call my sponsor now. Dear sponsor, I resent person on Twitter from a year ago because I like Paul McCartney. By the way, Paul is the best Beatle. Come on. Like, are we even, is this even a conversation? Paul carried John's water from about 1966 on. And yes, George was awesome. And yes, All Things Must Pass. I mean, what an incredible album. And it showed that he was getting totally ripped off in terms of the songwriting. Like, hey, we're putting you on the album, man. It's like, oh, no, you get one. And oh, so does Ringo. It's like, what? However, Paul's the best Beatle. So does he deserve $1 billion? I don't know. Probably not. Okay, so question that came in from Genevieve de Graves, who is going to be a guest on this. What we're going to do as we get into interviews, our next interview is going to be with Jess Salguero, who, I don't even know what she's been on. She's on everything. She's the best. She's a dear friend. She's also just one of the most prolifically talentedly working actors in Toronto and therefore in North America. Because Toronto fucking rocks. Jupiter's Legacy, her and I were both on The Boys, her and I were both on Tiny Pretty Things, and then she's on 90,000 other things because she's like that and deserves it. So what we're going to do for that one is the study, that's what I call my office, Zoomed, recorded, the way people are doing. And then other than that, I'll be doing the driving casts. Genevieve de Graves is also going to be one of our guests down the road. And she asked me, I can't look at this right now, so I'm paraphrasing. You know what I need? I need stickies on the dash. How did you know, like, what was the moment you knew you had to get clean? Was it uncomfortable? And I know you asked one other part of that, Jean-Bieve, and I don't remember what the other little part was. And then I think you did say, if you're comfortable talking about it, just so you know when you're writing in these questions, I'm comfortable talking about anything. Now, quick note on that. I've had a lot of people compliment me for my vulnerability. Relating facts to me is not an inherently vulnerable thing. So if there's a fact, including around my past or my own behavior, you know, it's not that vulnerable. You know, it just isn't. I only say that because I never want to be a Svengali or a bullshit guru. And when you get a little wisdom and a little knowledge, or you do what I do, you teach karate, you teach acting, you coach, you know, people can hang on what you're saying. And I think that's right only insofar as it serves them, not serving me. And so I say that because when I've had people be like, wow, you're so vulnerable. I'm like, take the wow away. Maybe there's a vulnerability to it, but in real time, if I'm sitting on my couch and I turn to my girlfriend and I'm like, baby, I'm really worried I'm blah, blah, blah. My career is failing, or I feel like I'm not enough for you, or I feel like I'm getting old, or I feel like I'm not good enough in bed, or I feel like I'm sorry that I've been withholding this week, and I'm blah, blah, blah. That's probably some vulnerability. That's some opening up in real time. Even me telling you about that now. I've had these conversations with her. Telling you about it, I don't believe is the vulnerability. In any case, that's why I don't mind talking about anything. The other reason, and I think I mentioned this in the last podcast, is I'm happy to say I'd rather not talk about that. Instead of having a reaction to the fact you asked. I really don't think, you know, when I was younger, I was arrogant about the idea that if you ask for something and someone says yes, or, you know, they have the choice to say no. What I didn't realize is that you can create a dominating energy doing that kind of thing. And that while in a dog eat dog or fucking survival of the fittest type mindset, yeah. If I say, hey, can you blah, 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 and I say it in a tough tone, and you go, yeah. First off, if you're the yeah person, like I'm saying this with love because I can be that person often. It doesn't seem like it when I'm doing the podcast and I'm sharing my thoughts and I have opinions and there's no one here to counter them. But I can be that person where I get tight and I pause, fight, flight, or we didn't say this one when I was a kid, freeze. I'm a freezer. I've learned how to be a fighter. I'm a really great fighter. And if you came up to me and you fucking pulled out a knife and you were like, give me your wallet, I would run. I'd be a flighter in that moment. If I had to fight, though, I think it'd go okay for me. Because I love fighting. But I'm really a freezer. I've had to train those other two. Anyways, if somebody comes at you hard and your response is, yeah, sorry, grab some therapy, talk it through with some trusted people, because you deserve better than to be dominated by a domineering person. But I don't think domineering people are necessarily wrong. I really don't. They're them, you're you. The negotiation is every moment. Every moment's a negotiation, right? So when I was younger, I would tend more to the dominating aspect. I never admitted I was wrong. And so people either got the choice to kind of agree with me, present an idea I found exciting, or choose not to be my friend or boyfriend or whatever. And a lot of that happened. So, you know, it wasn't just that, right? We all know this is three-dimensional and complicated in terms of why we behave that way, how that manifests. You know, I had an ex-girlfriend who I made an amends to say she wasn't real positive about the amends, which is fine. It's technically for me to drop the weight, and her response is for hers to own for herself. And then she sent me an article about dealing with narcissists because that was her experience with me. And interestingly, the article was about Al-Anon people who've been subject to an alcoholism. Their response is sometimes narcissists are real appealing. And the irony is that my narcissism wasn't, you know, whatever, DSMV, whatever, you know, therapeutically determined narcissism. It was the appurtenance of narcissism through my own response to having been subject to alcoholism and needing control because I was always out of control as a kid through the environment. That's the irony, is if I could have known her experience and had some sense of maturity, I could have said, oh my God, we're actually in the same boat, but we've manifested it as a weird compliment, which isn't terribly healthy. Anyways, Genevieve. So this is interesting for me. I had 100 rock bottoms. I had 100 moments where I knew I had to get clean. I think about 6 months after I started doing cocaine. And I mean, like, tried it once when I was 22. Never touched it again until I was, like, 23, 24. Twice in my life. And then something happened when I was 25 and we were off. So within 6 months of that 25 and on period, one night I was up all, like, for 3 days in a row. I literally drove to my parents' house at the tail end of a bender, and at like 8 a.m. knocked on their door, went in and sat them down and told them I had a drug problem. 6 months in, I already knew it had a hold of me. To be clear, I didn't get sober for another 6.5 years. But I meant it, right? I did that not as a high impulse. That was Sean's true self shining through, going, you're better than this, brother. I'm not saying better than drugs. I don't really care if people do drugs. Better than to give up everything for drugs, right? So I understood I had already an addiction. I used to say to my karate teacher before that whole period, I mean, maybe it was just around the time I was getting the first tastes. If it weren't for karate, I'd probably be a heroin addict. Well, at that point, I was never going to do heroin. I never knew anybody who'd done heroin. Like, heroin was the, like, deepest, darkest well of, like, whatever. But I innately understood that I had these tendencies. Well, flash forward a few years later when, you know, some real attractive girl's back in my house pulling out a brown vial. And yeah, now I'm doing heroin. Right? So I'm not really answering your question, Genevieve. Yeah. So I had so many moments of clarity. I had so many rock bottoms. And my physical rock bottom was brutal. My hands were swollen. My veins were all fucked up. I was puking. I was shit. I used to go to the bathroom in a bucket next to my bed because I couldn't make it to the bathroom. And then later, maybe the drugs would wear off or hit just right, and then I could actually go to the club and stuff. It's fucking brutal, dude. Like, I didn't get sober for no reason. I will say this. If somebody's out there not that far along but feeling like you might have an issue, I pray you don't use anybody else, including my story, as a standard for, oh, I'm not that bad. You probably aren't that bad, but you might be that bad internally. It's not what we did, it's what it does to us. So if you're having a negative response to your own relationship with that stuff, please, that's why I do that face when I'm like, do I tell this or not? Because it's part of the story, it's part of the answer, it's part of my life. But I'd be really sad if somebody was like, fuck, I need to like chill out or figure out a better way to live, and then hears that and goes, oh, I'm not doing that, fuck it, pass the beer. That's why I say that. But you might make that choice anyways. I can't control what choices you make, whether I tell a story right or not. That would be my own arrogance and narcissism. In any case, Genevieve, so rock bottoms, rock bottoms, rock bottoms. But 3 years later, I woke up one day, I'm talking about that physical rock bottom, and something in me had broken. Something in me had cracked wide open, and I just couldn't carry on. And for some reason that day, that was the real moment of clarity. If I'm being dead honest, I have no idea why that was different than a week earlier, a month earlier, or 7 years earlier. Again, this is a rambling, non-quotable answer because I wish it could be. I wish it could be like, ba ba ba, and everyone would go, ah, what a pearl. However, that does go back to action, not words, which is something I'm big on. I love words. I talk too much, but none of it means anything without action. And so I wasn't doing anything to get sober while knowing I should. Excuse me. While the light would emanate up through me and tell me, Sean, and I call it remembering. God, I'm going to cry if I think about the movie Spirited Away. Oh, if you haven't seen this, please watch it. I just want to go home. That's what all of us fucking addicts and many of us feel who aren't necessarily addicts but know that we're pushing too hard. I just got to get home. I just got to get to a place where I remember who I am. We're all connected to it, right? We're all authentic. We all come into this world spiritually, like perfect. We're perfect. Nothing bad at all. And then the world starts to play on us and we play back. And a lot of it's cool and a lot of it's awful defensive structures so that we get through a week or a day or a moment. And we build a way of thinking that lets us manage it and handle it. But we then can't. 5 years later, that way of thinking and managing doesn't work anymore and might not even be needed. And so a lot of us let down our guard only much later when we truly find a place where we feel safe. That's what happened to me. I finally got to a place where I felt safe. And I had been safe for a long time. I just didn't feel that way. And I realized that I can stop protecting, right? Because ultimate strength is vulnerability. That's a quotable. You can write that one on your vision board. Ultimate strength is vulnerability. Vulnerability is ultimate strength. When you don't need the armor, because whatever comes, you'll be fine with. And that for me came through choosing a God. I don't mind going there on the podcast. That's what I had to do, is choose something not me. And in fact, you know, to all my hippy dippy West Coasters who say universe, exact same thing. That which is everything. That's it. That which is everything. So when I started to get in touch with that which is everything, guess what? I started remembering again. I started going home again. And I don't mean, you know, Guelph, Ontario. Lovely home, by the way. We sold it to a guy who makes guitars and is converting the attic I used to play in into a guitar making studio in the basement where it was all moldy. And well, it wasn't necessarily moldy. It was damp. That's the word. That's now got guitars hanging in it. Like, it couldn't be a more beautiful handoff. And we haven't met, but we're mutuals and we chat. He has a Porsche too. Like, lovely guy. Anyways, sometimes things work out beautifully. Home is remembering the connectedness and the clarity and the vitality that we get to walk through this world with. So I'd get these emanations of it and I wouldn't do anything around it. I wouldn't take any action. People would be like, oh, well, in fact, I remember speaking to a doctor about it. And he goes, well, in my experience, 12 steps, the only thing. Oh, no, I don't have that kind of problem. First off, all I knew about 12 step is it meant you were saying you were an alcoholic, and I wasn't that. Why wasn't I that? Don't know. Didn't know what it meant. Just knew it wasn't me. Stigma. Okay, so stigma kept me out of it. The idea of a God, that kept me out of it. It's called a reservation. I had all these reservations. I reserve the right to keep getting high and drunk because I'm going to pretend I've investigated an idea I haven't. Then I'm going to reject the idea, not try the thing, i.e. do the action. And then I've reserved, hey, next Friday, I'm going to reserve a table at Three Beers Inn, call the dealer Coke Town. Oh, wait a minute. I thought you weren't drinking. I'm not. But I'm reserving that right for next Friday because I'm rejecting, prior to investigation, everything that might be useful or helpful. Goes back to October 7th, 2007. I flipped that. Anyways, my sober day is not important to you guys. In 2007, I had a moment where I just was for some reason able to do things differently. That one will forever be a mystery to me. I'll forever be grateful to it. Is what it is. I hope that's helpful to anybody listening. It got a bit rambly there, as I tend to. But it's really important for me. It's just like, how many times have you said you're going to get fit? I don't mean you, Jean-Biev. I mean all of us. How many times have you said you're going to pick up the guitar and practice? You either do or you don't, right? Yoda said it. There is no try. There's only do. Yeah, so it's one of those things where unless we're doing the thing, we're just talking about the thing. And talking about the thing's great. Talking about the thing can be priming us. We can prime ourselves. Oh, my God, I haven't shared this with you. I was priming myself for a certain physical conditioning and had a movie go away. My I was gonna be I should be in France right now. I was gonna bring this camera, do podcasts from quarantine in my hotel in Paris, and France locked down to non-citizens, including EU, and so I lost the gig. It is what it is. I'm not mad at anyone about it because it is what it is. But Shawnee B felt the COVID pinch. I'm not gonna lie to you. I enjoyed the day and a half of fuck you, fuck this. And the way my mind works is it doesn't go like, fuck you, France. Like, I don't know these people, this project. It's not like I'd started it. Like, you can't lose anything you actually have, right? So this project, it's not like I was there and got fired. Or what do we even have anyways? So what can we really lose? Yeah, I can lose a pair of sunglasses, but maybe they weren't mine to begin with in the whole spiritual scheme of it. There's a whole rabbit hole there that I kind of believe in, having lost many pairs of sunglasses. Maybe I just borrowed them for a while from the universe. So it's not about the gig, but what happens is something going away. I literally opened up one day. The next morning I wake up and I'm mad at a guy who I was roommates with in college who just walked out of my life one day with no explanation, none since. Right? So things going away becomes the icon of pain when I wake up the next morning. That lasted a day and a half. But my God, there's people who've lost loved ones. There's people who've gotten sick to the point where they need heart operations because of COVID. To all you fucking COVID denier anti-masker fucks, what is it now? 460,000 Americans dead? Sorry, I thought you were turning the corner. Sorry, I thought this was just like the flu. Sorry, I thought this was going to miraculously disappear. Get your fucking heads in the game and understand that science, while imperfect, because it's a process. Science is not an answer. Science is a process. But it's a process that takes in repeatably provable facts and then creates theories around it that are, again, repeatably provable based on the evidence, the observations, the facts. But that is changing over time as our instruments get sharper, as our this and our that. So the idea that, you know, one time Fauci made the mistake of saying don't wear masks because he wanted to make sure frontline workers had them and he wanted people not to touch their face too much because that was actually a big problem. Now jagoffs are still hanging on that March information and won't take in any new information. So anyways, the thing's real. The effects are real. But many people have not had ill effect or got COVID and recovered from like a flu. So God, good for them. That's amazing. But it doesn't negate what's actually happening. This goes back to what I was saying last week about the fact that I've had a wonderful time during COVID. But for me to say that is kind of shitty because that negates the fact that I am part of a group of people. And can it really be a wonderful time? And I think the answer is both. I think the answer is both. I don't know how my headset's working. I wonder how my headset's working. We'll find out later when I edit all this. I just clocked on my screen that it went, I think, from here to my Bluetooth in the truck. I don't even know which is better. I should do a bit more experimenting, but we're lucky the GoPro mount is working so well. So we're going to call that a win for the technical side of our show today. But so, yeah, I felt the COVID pinch. I lost a job over it. Or didn't lose it, depending on if you agree or not with what I just said, that you can't lose anything you never had. I had the contract. It was a legit thing. It wasn't like, oh, I hope I get it. So my initial response was, damn it. Like, fuck. I was so excited to do this movie. I was priming myself. That's the whole point of the story. And then I had this date by which I wanted to look a certain way physically and also, oh, we're getting the sun again. Also feel a certain way, in terms of my French and who the guy is, that I was playing in the film. And, yeah, I don't get to do that. So all of a sudden I'm now eating, Reese's Pieces, which are so good, and salt and vinegar chips in the basement, watching Animal Kingdom, which is so good. The second feeling I had was relief. Because I didn't have to quarantine in France for a week and then possibly stay in the Canada COVID hotel on the way back and quarantine in my own house in like a granny suite away from my girlfriend because she works for 2 weeks. So the fact that I didn't have to do that was actually also a mitigating factor. And somebody asked me how I was doing this morning. I was like, great. I've had a great fucking week. I'm pretty happy that I had a great week during a week when I lost a job. The old Sean would be so mad at the world right now. But I got a bit of faith. Okay, I pulled over because there's another question from Catherine Cahoot. Hi, Catherine. What's something technique-wise that you've learned from another actor? What's something you've borrowed from other people's work or people in your life that you use in your work? Okay, great questions. So, technique-wise, that from another actor. You know, technique-wise, it's all, it starts with actual technique, okay? So, I don't believe really in film and TV courses. I was taught that way, and I kind of am like, yeah, we have an iPhone. You know what you look like on camera. Play with how you look on video. Decide what you like. There's your on-camera acting course. However, I do believe in acting courses. You know, Brando never took an on-camera acting course. Diane Lane never took an on-camera acting course. Meryl Streep never took an on-camera. They learned how to act. They trained as actors. And then the other thing was easy to translate. So for me, when I got on my first TV show, I literally had to learn what a mark was. I didn't know what focus was. I didn't know what a clean trap was. And this goes to the I might be wrong aspect. Gabe Hogan, who I adore, dear friend, he was the he was one of the other four leads on the first TV show I did. And Gabe had booked all the work in Toronto. If you're my age and you're an actor and you're listening to this, you know what I'm talking about. Gabe was the guy we all hated because Gabe, if he was auditioning, he just kind of got the role. He'd been acting since he was a teenager. He's gorgeous. He's talented, blah, blah, blah. But I didn't realize he was talented. So I was like, fuck that guy. He can't act like me. I'm such a better actor than him. Fuck that guy. So early on in the process, I'm clocking how lovely Gabe is. And I was like, okay, well, he's a great guy, but fuck, I can act better than him. So we're doing a scene where my character, Gabe cuts off my character. And my line is like, well, I gotta dot, dot, dot. And so it's my coverage. And so that means it's close up on me. And so I'm like, yeah, the thing is that I gotta, and I don't hear him cutting me up. And so I start riffing. I start improv-ing. I go on for like 30 seconds. And in my head, I'm like, woo, look, mama, no hands. I'm acting. Look at this. This guy can't even fucking hang. And then they go, okay, great, going again. We do it again. Nothing. Like, he will not fucking play. He cannot keep up with the Benz. That's me. I nicknamed myself Benzo. Woo! Well, guess what? The sound guy walks up to me after about four takes and goes, hey, Sean, can you cut yourself off? We need a clean trap. And I'm like, what? And he goes, well, a clean trap. If he overlaps, we're bound to that take or his take. And, you know, it really gets difficult to edit. And since we're in close-up, we'd like a clean trap. So you just have to cut yourself off on the word. And I went, absolutely, Brian. And I probably bullshitted some reason why the first few takes I like to feel it out. There's a reason I don't do cartoons, because I just made my throat hurt. So, as I do the next take, I look at Gabe, and I finally see him. And he's waiting patiently while supporting me to find the take. I was wrong. So, Catherine, first off, I learned technically all along the way. I still do. First movie I did with Harrison Ford, he used to kind of crane his neck when he was in close-up. And I'd sort of be like, fuck this guy, man. He doesn't, he's not in the moment. I wasn't really, fuck this guy. It's Harrison Ford. I was sort of like, huh, that seems disingenuous. And then, you know, you realize, like, there's ways to look better on camera and pop. And it is a two-dimensional, one photograph, 24 frames a second medium. Well, the guy's a master. So I learned little things like that. In terms of things I've stolen from other actors, the best, finest person I've ever worked with is named Richard Thomas. Richard Thomas, most famously, was John Boy in The Waltons. And my second TV series, we were co-leads along with Lisa Lackey. The three of us did a show called Just Cause. And one of the most incredible, full-hearted, kind, talented people, bar none, I have ever worked with. And the one thing, and this is interesting, Catherine, because we've done the Meisner work together, is that, and for those of you who don't know why I say that to Catherine, is I strongly believe there's no such thing as character. When I first started acting, there was this thing called character over there, and then there was me, and I tried to become the character. These are phrases that I'd heard that I was like, I'm going to be the character. And it's like, right. But as soon as I made it the character, it wasn't me, and therefore I could never be it. If you know Zeno's paradox, if you shoot an arrow at a target, you can mathematically prove it will never hit the target. Because to get there, it has to cover half the distance. And then it has to cover half the distance again. And then it has to cover half the distance again. And mathematically, you can prove that there's an infinite number of halves. And therefore, it has to cover an infinite amount of space. And therefore, it can never hit the target. That's mathematically provable. Well, that to me is why I always sucked at playing a character. And once I found Meisner and I learned that, oh, it's me who's seeing the person across from me. It's me who wants to kiss them, hurt them, have them like me, blah, blah, blah. We know all the stuff that is contained. And then the character rests in the character of the script. So this is my party line. I teach this. I believe this. However, I'll use anything that works. It's called acting. It's an art. It's for fun and for free. It's playtime. So I train that way. But then I let all of it go on set. I mean all of it. All of it. And by this, you know, I've been doing Meisner for 17 years now. I don't even emotionally prepare anymore because my body opens up when it knows where it needs to go. Because if I emotionally prepare, I'm going to fucking yell or cry too much. So anyways, Richard Thomas always used to talk about his guy. He used to call it his guy. The character he was playing on that show was his guy. And so he'd be like, oh, I wonder how my guy walks. I wonder how my guy talks. And even though I fully have abandoned the idea of character, I've never abandoned the idea of my guy. What does my guy move like? What does my guy think? And it's a way to put the guy over there. Now, I'll never become that guy, but I can dress that guy up and use him as a detached way to explore possibilities that I might not touch upon if it's always me. I hope that makes sense, Catherine. I'm sure it does. It does in my head. It's very clear. But it's a way, for example, I was writing a script of a feature film and I kept sticking on the character's behavior. And fundamentally, this is a part I was writing to play myself. I don't care if I do or don't, but it was how I was writing it. And I decided that I was going to put Christian Bruin in when I pictured the guy. And now I could write with a bit more freedom because I could put Christian in situations that I would defend if you were going to put me in them. So I had to be able to put the character in the shit and make the character lose and also make the character make choices that I would justify not making. So I had to make him that guy. And in fact, I used a friend who's also a brilliant actor and could hang the character on Christian as a costume. So that's an idea, Catherine, my guy, that I've used ever since. And then, shit, hold on. My phone's here on a mount now. People I use in my work. Yeah, I wanted to check that out because that's important. I use my family a lot. I'll play my dad. I'll play my mom. I'll play my brother. I think familial stuff's really cool. And so I know my brother's rhythms. I know my mom's rhythms. I know my dad's rhythms. And so I'll use them in that way. Anyone who went to theater school with me knows I'm really good at impressions, but they're not literal. They wouldn't be funny to anyone else who doesn't know the teachers we had or the other students. And it was just sort of it's like a rhythm and an energy. And yeah, at theater school, we were spending such an intense amount of time with each other that I was picking that up almost like it was family. But yeah, I use my family a lot. I technically like Catwoman. I know some people watching or listening are fans of that. Yeah, I just played my dad. Now, the beauty is that I can't be my dad, right? So I wasn't trying to in any – it was a springboard. And I think about it the way John Mayer talks about writing music. It was one of these songs that everyone said he wrote for Katy Perry. I still feel like your man. Mama. And at the concert, he goes, everybody thinks I wrote this song for someone. No, I wrote it for you. Now, I might have written it because of someone, but it's for you. And I really like that. I adopted that, you know. I've written some songs for people, but it's not really for them at a certain point. It's springboards. And I realized, no, it's because of them. You know, I literally wrote a song called Stevie because of a person named Stevie, but it's not for her. If anything, it's for me, because I'll drop it on iTunes eventually, but it's for me because I need to process. But what happens in the processing is it's no longer about her. So there's the because of, about, and for. Those are the three. Because of her, I started writing the song. It starts about her, but all of a sudden a theme takes hold that has nothing to do with that person. And then now it's not even about that person, and then it's for the listener or myself. I really believe that. Now, why am I going on about that? By the way, The Wedding Anniversary, I think that's the name of the movie. Alan Cummings, Jennifer Jason Leigh, they co-directed it. It's fucking amazing. Go watch it. He puts Gwyneth Paltrow in a movie, and Jennifer Jason Leigh thinks she should have played it in the movie. And she, like, says, it's embarrassing that you wrote this character that's me, and I'm not playing it because you think I'm too old. And he just kind of yells at her in this fight they have that's a really awesome scene and says, it's not you. It's every woman I've ever met. And he sort of ends with, including my mother. And I love that because that's right. You know, even if you describe it almost identically, for me, it's a springboard. And so in that sense, I use, let's say I play my dad in Kept Woman. Still not really. It's just a springboard. It's just a pew. Now we're off to the races because we have a starting point. And then I'm not really playing my dad after a certain point because, as we all know, it comes back to it's me. I'm doing it. If anything, I played my dad for the first two scenes with a bit of a walk and talk. And then the producers are like, whatever you're doing, keep doing it. And I go, great. Now this is mine. Now this is mine. I hope that's a bit of an answer to your question. Wow, what are we talking about? Still -7 out there. It's a chilly one. I'm gonna stop this one here. This has been a beautiful drive. I'm almost near where I need to go for my errands and to do my stuff. And I can't wait to see the response. By the way, I'm not sure how all this stuff works. But enough of you listened, and I know some of you are watching now, so I'm not even getting all the podcast stats. Like number 118th out of like 7,000 podcasts on my aggregator in comedy. I mean, look, I hadn't posted in 4 years, so it jumped like 5,000 spots, maybe even a lot more than that. Anyways, my point is, I appreciate y'all listening. Wow, that was, if I ever run for politics. Anyways, I appreciate, thumbs up to you. Here's the thing. Nice work on listening to the podcast. But I will say this, the best thing you can do is share it. And then people I watch on YouTube videos say this, and I don't find it cheesy. Smash that like button. Share it. Tell your friends about it. Why not, right? Let's climb the ladder and get into the top 100, and then let's get into the top 10, and then let's get some sponsors, and then let's make me rich. And then let's make me a really good person who gives money to all the right places and uses my richness and influence to shape our society for the better. Woo! That's some big Sunday goals, my friend. But you know what? Most people's mistake is they don't set their goals high enough. Let's Oprah this shit up. Why don't we? Why not? If anyone can, then anyone else can. Last thing that I meant to mention. What is a guaranteed measure that someone's an asshole? Even if they think they're a good person. I have one. Toilet seats. I had to use a public bathroom today, and I went in, and there's piss on the toilet seat. I don't care who you think you are. I don't care what public persona you present. If you exit a toilet and you've left piss on the toilet seat, you're an asshole. We know this, right? You're an asshole. There's a great way you can check if you're an asshole or not. Ask yourself, have I ever been an asshole? Am I an asshole? Now, I don't know what you're supposed to do at 1 a.m. at the bar, with all the graffiti in the basement and there's no doors on the stalls and you walk in and it's covered in piss. But it wouldn't be covered in piss if from the word go, the first asshole wasn't an asshole. As we all know, once someone's an asshole, it's easier for more people to be an asshole. So maybe I don't want to be negative about this. Fuck it. Fuck you, assholes, seat pissers. But if you're a seat pisser, you're an asshole. Don't be an asshole. Why I was saying I don't want to be negative is maybe we'll do a little segment each week, which is what's a measure of an asshole? Oh, the other thing I was going to say, and this is when I was mentioning the sponsorship and me becoming the next Oprah. Let's do it. Let's do it. Let's climb this. Let's get Oprah about this. So this is free, right? You're just watching this. You're just listening to this. I'm not saying there's a cost of entry to this podcast. There isn't. But what I'm saying is if you wanted there to be one, how about we make an agreement that every time I do a podcast, and it gets cast, I'll commit an anonymously good act within the next 48 hours. And your covenant with me and mine with you is that you'll do the same. So you listen to this podcast, you made it this far. How about the price for me to have people listening and giving me that thing that I need from that? And for you to get your hour convo back and forth is that you go commit an anonymously good act. And if someone sees you commit it or you tell your partner about it, doesn't count. You got to do another one. Shall we make that deal? I will make that deal with you right now. Virtual handshake. All right. Thanks for listening. Here we go. Let me see if I can get this right. Chatting Between Takes, season 2: I might be wrong. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you for the next one. My God, I'm loving that this gear all works. Aye.